It's great to see you all here. And, you know, in the last, these 2 weeks, we've taken a bit of a break from our Romans series that we've been traveling through for a good chunk of time already. And I think we're into chapter 10, 11. So we're making great progress in the letter of Romans. But we thought in these last 2 weeks, we would just take a little bit of a break. Last week, Pastor Brian talked about this table and why each and every week we practice coming to the table. If you weren't here last week, I encourage you to just listen and to once again hear why we as a community shape our life around this table. We also, and as Brian mentioned last week, talked about how this table is the kind of table we want to extend into the world. Instead of talking about evangelism, we sometimes use the language extending the table, creating a place where people can come and encounter the reality of the risen Lord. And we see our people, ourselves as people of the table. A couple years ago, maybe just a year ago or so, we as a community sort of got together and started thinking about what does it mean to be God's people here where we live. And we did a lot of work around that, and we started thinking about particularly how God might call us to live. And one of the things we talked about in terms of extending our lives into our world was the idea of Emmaus. Emmaus groups, neighboring groups. And today I want to talk about that, talk about how we have developed and what we are learning. And I want to introduce to you three people. And they're going to talk a little bit about their experience in Emmaus groups from different angles. But we'll leave that to a little bit later. It really has come upon us as a key conviction that we need to get into our neighborhoods. I mean, Monica and I sit at our table in our living room or in our kitchen. And we live in a neighborhood where, you know, if you just talk too loud, your neighbors might hear you, which is really problematic when you've got two kids around and you're trying to control them at times. But as we sit down at our table with our boys and we see our neighbors go about, we ask ourselves, are we really being what God wants us to be in our neighborhood? I mean, how many of you live in a neighborhood? Hey, all of you. Who doesn't? Who doesn't? You live out somewhere on a hill, on a farm, a few of you. But many of us live in a neighborhood. There's homes about you. When you think about your neighborhood, how many names of your neighbors do you know? Those people that live across the street or a few houses down. Monica and I asked each other, if we were to move out of our own neighborhood, would our neighbors miss us? Would they be sad that we departed? Would they feel like they lost friends? When was the last time you prayed for one of your neighbors who doesn't go to your church? That you knew about one of their needs? Perhaps a challenge, maybe an economic challenge, maybe a health challenge. Do you know your neighbors? How often do you sit down and chat it up with your neighbors? That might be more common. But does anybody in your neighborhood know that you know them and that you care about them? And these are some of the questions that are beginning to burden Monica and I more and more. Now, we have lived in our neighborhood for about 20 years. We moved into British Columbia, you know, maybe 21 years ago, and when we decided to purchase a home. We were at the time serving in another church that bought property right on the hill that we bought our home. So we thought, we'll just buy a home right there and we'll just get into the neighborhood. It was a brand new neighborhood, Clover Valley Station. Some of you live there. It was one of those first neighborhoods where you had the front porch, sidewalks, everybody was sort of compressed in, and everybody would be this friendly, happy, neighborly type of situation, and it was a blast. We all had street parties. Every year, everybody would come out, we would close the street down, we'd roll out the barbecues, and we'd get all kinds of stuff going. It was a great, great time. We even, as a community, helped build that playground right in our park. And I remember slugging it out in the sod and rolling out, you know, some of the gravel and all the kinds of work that was required. We were proud of our community. And then the house prices started to climb. And our neighbors started moving. Moved from one neighborhood to the next. New neighbors moved in. Wow. And they weren't sort of interested in the street party. They didn't come here for the street party. They just came to get their house, I suppose. And some of us old fogies, well, we still like the friends that moved away, so we would jump into our car and go off to visit them, and so on and so on. And now we're in this place where, who are our neighbors? And so we've gone through this shift over a number of years, and Monica and I are getting a little bit older, and then some of them moving in are a little bit younger, and so it's like, how do we do this? And how do we go about it? And ultimately, the question is, should we care? Should we care how we are doing in our neighborhood? Should you care about your neighborhood? Now, ever since we all worked together to discern God's mission for us, we concluded together that neighborhoods, our neighborhoods, are the very mission fields God is calling us into. As we were thinking those thoughts, as we were beginning to sort of say or have this burden of neighborhoods, somebody asked a very real question, well, what does that look like? I think it was Glenn that basically asked that question. Well, what does this look like? If neighborhoods are the place of mission for us, what does this look like? And at that point, there was maybe four or five of us in the room, and we go, we don't know. Not exactly sure. And yet there was a compelling burden that moving to the neighborhood or beginning to embrace our neighborhood was important. We're not sure, you know, at that point we were pretty sure it didn't necessarily mean going door to door with a briefcase or handing out pamphlets. But we needed to do something, and so we came up with this idea of creating these mid-sized groups in our neighborhoods where those who lived in the area from the church could begin to gather and begin to think about what it might mean to be a people of God in one's neighborhood and beginning to think through that together. And as we began talking about this thing and even beginning to launch these things about a year ago, lo and behold, this idea that germinated that we have now called Emmaus Groups, and I'll get to that in a minute, lo and behold, other churches were also beginning to think this and work through this need to become more neighborly in terms of our Christian lives. And in fact, the district as... our district, we're part of this district of the Christian Missionary Alliance, the Pacific District, and the head honchos, who in fact the head office is right here in Cloverdale, it's sort of handy for us. They phoned us up and said, we know you're doing something about these things, and there's a number of churches, in fact, from Calgary all the way to Vancouver, who are doing the same kinds of things as you are, and we're thinking of bringing them all together to start thinking about this. So, in fact, there's three or four churches in Calgary, Center Street, it's interdenominational, Granville Chapel, and some others, Langley Evangelical Free. And so, we just started, we had one of four meetings. Over the 18 months, we're just sort of hanging out with each other, for 2 days and just what's happening in your midst. What are you learning? What are we learning? But what's exciting about that is that there's something new beginning to develop, and Pacific is beginning to sort of grow into this neighboring idea. In fact, it was Center Street, as I listened to their story, and that's a church we visited a few months ago. They had this big Alpha initiative, and Alpha Canada worked with them, and they started about 75 different Alpha groups, and they started them not on their main campus or any of their campuses, but in restaurants, motel, banquet halls, or whatever. And 75 different groups sort of happened, of about 20 or 30 people each, or and some larger. And then after the event of Alpha and the number of weeks, they were like, what do we do now? Do they all come to one of the satellite campuses or the main campus? What do we do? And so they had these groups that emerged, and all of them at the end said, can we keep this thing going? Because each of these 75 different events were neighboring Alpha groups. And so it's exciting hearing from them how they are beginning to think about how do we work within our community. And so we're spending time with a number of churches over the next number of months to learn from them and they from us. Because there's this growing conviction, or this conviction about neighboring, but it seems to be very consistent with what Jesus told his disciples. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations. Now, when we hear that, we think, that's a good call for missionaries. But not all the disciples went out beyond the places where they lived. Not only did it include faraway places, it included your neighborhood. In fact, when missionaries go out, one of the primary concepts that shape their good missionary thinking is they move into a place to do what? They move into a neighborhood to become good neighbors and thereby do the work of mission. In fact, Monica and I met this very young couple, newly married, maybe 3 or 4 years. They had a 2-year-old boy and one coming. And Monica knew them. I don't know them from anybody, but she was the daughter of one of Monica's childhood friends. Sarah is her name. And she married Brandon. Brandon is probably the craziest young man I've ever met. And I met him finally, and Sarah and their son, and they stayed over our night, and he had just begun to bike across Canada with wife in tow and their one kid and one on the way in a van, and they're crossing Canada to raise awareness and funds for their missions trip. Well, I'm sort of interested in, well, what's this trip all about, this missions trip? And he shared, he's quite the character. He goes, we're starting a family, and I was sort of finished this ministry experience on this college campus, and we woke up one morning, and we need to buy a house. We're having a family. They started looking for a house in the area, Ontario. They couldn't afford anything. And Braden goes, I wonder what the prices of homes are in Tanzania. He had traveled to Tanzania once. And I wonder what the prices are in Tanzania. He does a Google MLS search, however you find real estate in Tanzania, finds this property by this game reserve in Tanzania. Hey, Sarah, what do you think? Price is right. So they start exploring this property, and who lives there? Oh, the refugees. Well, who are the refugees? Well, they're sort of this group that's never been touched by Christianity. And I'm going, oh, just a minute here. Well, as it turns out, one thing led to the other. They connected with a missionary organization called SIM. They're now missionaries. They got a property in this refugee land, and they just moved there last month. He's crazy. But what are they doing? Buying a property and contributing to their neighborhood and hoping to build relationships so that they the refugee who have never heard the gospel before can be transformed by the presence of God. Now, not all of us are called into that. And what a way to become a missionary, looking for property. But this very concept that missionaries live into is really neighboring. That's what they're doing. It's what God is calling us into. My favorite missiologist, Leslie Newbigin, claims this concept is completely consistent, if not synonymous, with the doctrine of the incarnation. Now, the Gospel of John puts it this way. The Word became flesh, and he what? Made. He made his dwelling amongst us. He packed up what stuff he had up in heaven, so to speak. And you hauled it all the way down to earth. In fact, he got too small of a trailer. And he left much behind in terms of all he was to live amongst us. He dwelt amongst us. He neighbored amongst us. Karl Barth, perhaps one of the most influential theologians of the 20th century, some say of him that he is probably the most, the theologian that has most described what it means to be a neighboring community. In fact, one little quote out of his Dogmatics. I have a friend who really loves Karl Barth. I grew up in a seminary that didn't like Barth, but Barth is pretty refreshing. And so for really my friend's sake, because you'll probably listen, this is really why I'm doing it. But here's the quote. No matter who or what he is, the neighbor is our future. And it indicates the order in which God wills to be praised by us. There's a lot more that Barth says about this, but he says it all here. That our very future is in our neighbor. And how we live towards our neighbor in terms of God's commands to us is how God describes how we give praise to God, is by how we orient ourselves to our neighbor, to others. And Barth grounds this on Jesus' answer to the question when somebody asked him, what is the most important command? What is the most important command, Jesus? And Jesus responds, love God with all your heart, with all your mind, and with all your soul, all your strength. And the second is like it. What is it? Love your neighbor as yourself. These are, as Jesus says, the greatest command. This is the greatest command. In fact, it's interesting. He doesn't say these. He does. It's sort of plural, but he brings this sense that these two are almost synonymous. They're distinct. They're different. But they don't seem to be all that subordinated to one another. Love God and then love your neighbor. It seems that their two have this dynamic relationship. That to love God is, in fact, to be loving your neighbor. That somehow when we love God, we are just automatically living for the sake of the other. It's really no choice, in fact. To love God is to be a neighbor for the sake of another. Well, some of these things have shaped the way I think about Emmaus groups and perhaps much of the conviction about how we need to be a community that neighbors. And thus we've come up with this concept, this ministry concept of Emmaus groups. This conviction that if we are the people of God, we need to embrace the neighborhoods where we live. And this is part of our mission. In fact, let me just look at our distinctives for a bit. Because really, this message is about and this time together. And I really hope that after we listen to a few of our own members here, that we can just put this to prayer together. Because I think God is putting us on a journey. But our distinctives put it this way. And we have seven distinctives, but here's the one distinctive we call a missional community. We've agreed that we are a people in mission seeking to effectively testify to the good news in our neighborhoods and the nations of the world. That we see ourselves as people who are concerned about the nations all around, but we are also concerned about the mission right at home. That ultimately we're all missionaries, so to speak. In fact, we explain this further. You probably can't read that, but let me read it. We say, God is on a mission. As the Father sent his Son, so Jesus is now sending us, empowering us by his indwelling Holy Spirit, as sent ones. We are to be the embodiment of the living Word in human culture and in social settings so as to display his divine nature and transforming power. And what's amazing about that is a recognition that we are part of God's mission, that God's mission works through us and our willingness to be used by him. And so we seek to engage the culture, both locally and abroad, declaring, speaking verbally, and demonstrated by acts, the gospel within the specific context of time, place, language, and culture. In fact, we seek to radically identify with the world. It's our world. It's God's world. While maintaining also a radical distinction from it. It's recognizing this is God's creation, but it also recognizes that it's a fallen creation. And we live in the tension of embracing Christ and embracing the world and living in new ways, in testimony and in demonstration that there's a new reality here. God's reality, God's kingdom. So this is what we've stated in our distinctives. This growing sense of what it means to be God's people. Our vision puts it this way, and this came after we scripted out these distinctives, but as we began to say, well, what does this look like? We put some tires to the road, so to speak. We seek to be a prophetic and life-giving presence of Christ, serving our neighborhoods and local communities so that our neighbors and friends will experience God's transforming love in Jesus. I mean, those are big commitments that we've made, big statements that we've embraced. And fundamentally, we are saying that we are, if we are true to what Christ calls the church to be, a church of mission. Now, this is not strange to us. In fact, this would be totally consistent with being part of the Christian Missionary Alliance. Mission to the world, mission to our communities. And so there's some things that we are saying that is the same, but it's also pushing us in perhaps new ways. And perhaps the most important demonstration of this value is this table. Christ welcomes us to his table. And note, it's a table. And it's a family table. It's a table like you might have in your own home. And Jesus demonstrated his whole life to his disciples, as you know, at a meal. Beautiful, powerful, and profound demonstration of the household reality of God's mission. I mean, was it really true that Jesus thought that homes and neighborhoods were key? Let's just take a look at that for a moment. When you read the Gospels, Jesus' favorite place of ministry was where? In people's homes. It was the place of his ministry. Jesus did most of his preaching and teaching in people's homes. I mean, yes, the Sermon on the Mount, it was a big day. Yes, he went to the synagogues. Yes, he went to the temple. But when you read the Gospels, note how often he's in people's homes. I mean, that was the big complaint, as you know, about him. He ate with the tax collectors and sinners. Well, where was he eating? In their homes. He was hanging out with them in their homes. We know the story when he was walking by the tax collector Zacchaeus and saying, hey, I'm coming. I mean, he invited himself into their homes. He took over their homes. His ministry happened in homes. He ate with Samaritans in their homes, and as a result, many came to faith in him. Read that in John chapter 4. It was at someone's home where Jesus was preaching that four guys broke through the roof. Why would they choose to break through the roof of a home? Why didn't they just wait for him at the temple? Or why didn't they wait for him in the courtyard? Because they knew that's where he hung out. If we're going to find Jesus, we're going to have to break through this roof in order to get our sick friend down to Jesus so that he can be healed. In the home. In fact, when he went to the Pharisees' homes, that's where he also confronted them. Oh, woe is you. I mean, he went and ate with them, but he wasn't always, you know, the friendliest. He also challenged people in their homes. And it was the place where Jesus taught his disciples. They always went to their homes to be instructed. It's where they asked the questions. It was a place of Jesus' ministry. It was the place of spiritual encounter. It's where Jesus showed up. And this underscores a changed reality. No longer was the ministry of God, the mercy and compassion of God, to be ministered directly through mediators of priests and temple, but that the very presence of God was happening in the ordinariness of our lives. The table. Profound realities. Ordinary setting. It was also a place of community. I mean, one of the favorite things it seems that Jesus did was eat. And of course, you eat in people's homes. And so the table. But after Jesus was crucified, where did he reveal himself? Oh, walking down the road with two disciples. The two disciples, their hearts burning in them, invite this stranger to come and eat with them. And then as Jesus, in this little neighborhood called Emmaus, when Jesus broke the bread, they saw. Jesus showed up in the home. The disciples carried on the practice. Oh, by the way, that's why we call them Emmaus groups. The disciples carried on this practice. The New Testament church expanded through a network of house churches. The gospel moved from home to home. In fact, the kingdom of God expanded through the real estate of God's people. Something transforming was happening as people came to Christ and offered themselves as willing servants of God. They turned over all their possessions and all of their sense of ownership, personal property, and said, it's God's. God gave it. It's God's. God use it. Barnabas was a landowner. What did he do? He sold off chunks of his property for the sake of the gospel. No longer did he see himself as one who needed to protect his financial future by making sure he had sufficient means, he now was transformed into a person for the sake of the gospel. He began to address the needs in his own community by turning it into the community. It was a transformed reality. I mean, imagine this. If we really believe that God moved through our real estate, to put it that way, we could almost hire a staff person that would just help us buy the best homes in the best neighborhoods to be able to be the best kind of neighborhood presence in our community. My point is that God uses us in our homes and our neighborhoods. But there's a couple of challenges. There's a couple of challenges living this out, because if we really buy into this idea, the reality is we haven't lived this way, really. It's really quite a new thing. There's a couple of big challenges. And the first is the challenge of being a real presence in our neighborhoods. A guy named Philip Langton, in his book, argues that since World War II, the front porch as the place of community, we watched, you watch that Mayberry show. You know that little town Mayberry? What's that show? Monica loves this show. It drives me nuts. Kids love it too. What's that show? Andy Griffith, right. We were watching one just the other day where they were on a Sunday. They all came out of church. Nobody was in the town, but they were all at church. They all come out of church. Some guy had broken down car, just wanted to get it fixed, trying to get everybody to get it fixed. Everybody was doing their Sabbath, peeling apples. And there's that sort of image of Mayberry where everybody knows everybody and knows the needs. Philip Langdon, in his book, argues that since World War II, the front porch as the place of community interaction and the focus of family activity has been overtaken by the secluded backyard, complete with pool and barbecue, trampolines, fences, tall hedges, canopies, shade things. No longer do we have front porches. In fact, we put our garages on the front. Hide the entrance in the corner and get our privacy in the back. Now, some neighborhoods like ours tried to do it different, but the porch is too small. They didn't even put a chair on it. It's just the idea of community, but you can't do community on our court, on our porch. But when you think about the kind of real estate, the kind of homes we have, it's about personal privacy, isn't it? It's this place where we can hide away, be ourselves, wear what we want, eat our own food, don't need to know our neighbors, build the fence higher. Ever since World War II, this guy Langdon says this has been happening. Sidewalks are absent. Public gathering places are secondary thoughts. And the primary principles directing architecture is personal convenience and privacy. So how do we be a neighboring kind of community when, in fact, everybody's door is shut tight, their gates are closed, and you can't even see your neighbor over the hedges? How does this happen? I don't know. Besides, we're the same people. Right? We've bought real estate on many of these principles ourselves. That's one challenge. The other challenge is this. Second is the challenge of a church-centric focus or a church-building-centric focus. Mostly our experience of God's mission in our lives has been very church-centric. What do I mean by that? Hey, if we want to do mission, we basically have to drag them into our church building. If we could just get them into our church building, then we've accomplished the mission and then the pastors can pick up the rest. So we just have to be nice and bring them to church and then mission will be done. And we've just done everything in the church building. We've got our youth rooms, our children's rooms. We've got the church offices. We've got the big sanctuary. We've got all these things. And if we could just get everybody into the place, then good things will happen. So we take them from where they live into a central building place. And this fits our society. I mean, we go to Home Depot to do this. We go to the grocery store to do this. We go to the fitness center to do this. And you got options, which is handy because you have a car. So now you can choose where you go. And everybody chooses something different because, well, there's so many options. And so you choose your church, the one that fits you. And of course, this is all driven, and Brian made great mention of that in terms of individualism and consumerism, and I won't go there today. But we have created a world that suits our convenience and fits our particular needs. Reggie McNeil is a church consultant type of guy, thinker type of guy, and has written in numerous books, and I was reading his most recent one, and what's it called here? Missional Communities, The Rise of the Congregational Church. And he says this. It's really quite interesting. And this is true, the last 20, 30 years. When I first came to be a pastor, it dawned on us that churches weren't really connecting to their neighborhoods. We didn't even know our neighborhoods. And so the idea was, well, why don't we get in touch with their neighborhoods? Let's find out who they are. So we do research and surveys and stuff so that this Christian community could then maybe understand their community. And that was one stage. And then it moved to another stage. Maybe we got to start doing things for our neighborhood. So then you move to do for. So we'll do this and we'll do that and we'll do this. But there's a new stage emerging, which I think is really helpful to understand. It's less about doing and now working with the community. And this is, I think, true of our own experience as we even think about kitchen ministry. It's not so much us doing things for, it's doing things with. For instance, Gloria and I just sat with Save On, Clayton and the managers of Clayton and the one here in Cloverdale. And they just so want to become part of the kitchen and work. And we're like, okay, how do we work with them? How do we help them live into serving their community? And how, as a church, can we embrace that and work with them? So we're sort of moving into that experience. So Reggie McNeil is saying we're into this new stage, and I think he's being a little bit prophetic because he's calling the church to move from a church-centric narrative to a kingdom narrative. To how, instead of being so preoccupied with church building and getting people to church, it's about how do we be God's people in terms of the kingdom? How do we be God's people? Instead of, it's a serving and a collaborating with. It's not about creating program clients, he says, but we're in the business or in the ministry of developing people, growing with people. And the difference can be described by understanding that church is not a what, an it, but a who. The church is not it, it's a who. He explains it this way. The next slide. Seeing the church as a what is seeing it as something outside of ourselves, something we go to, a place where certain things happen, a vendor of religious goods and services, something we support, something we invite people to attend. That's treating the church as a what. Seeing the church as a who, however, means that wherever the body of Christ is, the church is present. Thinking this way, followers of Jesus think of the church more as a verb than a noun. Church is not just an activity, it's a way of being in the world. And these followers of Jesus view their life, as a mission trip. They serve as kingdom agents in every part of their life. Now, as I sit down with my Emmaus group leaders, this is one of the biggest struggles. Because it seems that the younger you are, the more you embrace this. The older you are, the more challenging it is to embrace. millennials, less institutional, though there's a okay respect to it, and then there's others, the boomers are just like everything organized and figured out, and there's more free form in terms of the millennials and this way of living in the kingdom and being a presence in a community that can look at many different ways seems to be more suitable or more embraceable. But I think it's helpful to see the distinction between the what and the who. Our Emmaus group effort seeks to live into that, to find a way into this. So the question is, how are we doing? We're doing okay. So today I'm not going to sit here and tell you, you should, you must, you should quit what you're doing and do this. I'm not going to do that kind of talk. Some of you might be sitting here, I'm in a small group, or why would I give that up? I'm sort of happy. Fine, just fine. What I want us as a church to struggle with is, what does it mean to be God's people in mission in terms of our neighborhood? And as we pushed into our Emmaus groups, it was a way of us saying, here's our best way of doing it that we can think of at this point. And so what is it? We've created these regional places where those in our community can gather around 4 o'clock to meet those that live in the same neighborhood as them, begin to fellowship together. They eat, and many of the groups are beginning to sit down and talk about what it might mean to be God's people in their particular area. We meet once a month. There's about 6 groups. Some of them are thriving. Some of them are still finding their way. Tonight, I'm meeting with one group, and we're not sure if it's going to carry on. It's not like we've got this one all figured out. But we're committed to press, to find our way into what it means to be God's people where we live. So what have we been learning? Well, I'm going to ask a couple people to chat it up because I've done enough talking already. And I want to talk about some of the things about fellowship. And I'm going to talk to Doris in just a moment. And some things about mission, and I'm going to be talking to Russ over here in a moment. And some things about leadership, and I'm going to chat it up with Tone for a minute. So you can hear from them. They're a little bit of experience in terms of what's happening in terms of Emmaus and them. And then we'll wrap it up. But some things about fellowship. Perhaps it can best be said, I'm not going to ask Doris to come climb up here, but in terms of fellowship, it seems that as the groups met over the number of months, fellowship was the biggest deal. Just the opportunity to get to know one another is just a cool thing. And in fact, I've noticed after we've been doing that some people in the Emmaus groups are beginning to gather in certain centers in our church because they've built new friendships and now they get to sit beside each other because they're part of the same group. Beginning to see a little bit of that migration happening. But people are able to connect. And one of the reasons we started is because as new people came, we could say, here's a group that you can connect with, hang out with. Church is a bit difficult. I remember the first night when we were sitting down with the Murrayville group, and there's kids running all over, and it's a bit chaos because everybody's included, kids and all. Doris Murchison was sitting down. And I just want, you've been at Emmaus groups for a few months now, but could you share a little bit about what Emmaus has meant to you in terms of your life and your sense of being part of Pacific Community Church? If you can stand.
Yeah.
You could just have to stand a moment so that everybody can see you. Yeah. See her?
Yeah.
If you need to sit down, you can.
The Emmaus group has been a big happening in my life. I've found such fellowship there, and I look forward to going. I look forward to seeing the mothers and fathers with their children. I look forward to seeing these young people bringing up the children in the way they should go. And I've thought about the book of Acts many times, of how they all got together in one place, but they didn't stay in that one place. They went out from there. And there's so much I've learned. You know, I've never ever thought I've known it all ever, but there's so much that you can learn when you hear one another's stories and how excited they are about their lives in Christ. And you hear about their ups and downs, and you want so much for everyone you know to be there, to be part of this. And I pray about it, and I just ask God to constantly listen to his people's prayer and increase our numbers. And the biggest thing I've learned, that the most important thing, and I think this is what Jim's been talking about, is communication. We seem to have lost a lot of that. You know, when I was a child, we were out with our neighbors. I lived in a little village outside of London, and we were aware of all our neighbors. And today I worry about the kids doing this all the time on their iPads and not communicating. And, you know, we're all watching our televisions. We're not communicating. And I think this is our biggest problem that we need. And most of all, we need to be an outreach, an example for Jesus Christ.
Thanks, Doris. When you go to an Emmaus group, and we are so used to small groups of about 10 or 12 people, you leave the kids at home, they come in as adults, a nice adult experience, and you do a Bible study. It's not like that. You got kids, different people that you haven't chosen that live in your area that come out, and you're getting to know them and beginning to share life together. Now, we've got to grow in some of our Emmaus groups and learn more and more about what it means to be in fellowship and to grow together, but we're on that journey. In fact, I want you to listen to Russ here. I think I'll just walk to him, too, and he can share a little bit. But Russ is in our Emmaus group. In fact, we met him on the first Emmaus night in our group, and I'm not suggesting that Emmaus, you know, was a slam dunk for you to find your way into the life of Pacific, but it was a chance for us to get to know you as a community. But at the last Emmaus group, you shared a bit of a story about what it might mean to be a neighbor. And so less about fellowship, but now maybe a little bit more about how we as a community in our Emmaus group are thinking, what does it mean to be a neighbor? And so, anyways, can you share your story a bit? Welcome him, by the way. If you haven't met him, you've been around for a year or so.
Since September. Anyway, it's good. As Jim says, at one of the Emmaus groups there, he shared an acronym, and he can talk about it, called BLESS. You can engage him on that one. But it challenged, put the challenge out for us to go and be missional in our neighborhoods. Personally, that freaks me out. But had an opportunity recently to do just that. A friend was coming over just to get into the story, but I had some dirt that I wanted in my front flower bed. Simple thing. We probably all have something like that. He came over. A friend came over with some dirt in a utility trailer. And he had a friend with him. So I was going to be comfortable with him dropping the dirt in my driveway and then go on your way and I'll deal with the dirt. They stayed. They said, no, we're here. We're going to help you. Oh, okay. So we put the dirt in and we did about a yard of dirt in about 20 minutes. So that was nice. It was appreciative. Thank you. Away they go. And one of the friends stayed with me and we talked for a while. A neighbor across the street, who we'd been nice, we're very Canadian, we wave and say hello, but that's it. Don't want to go too far, wouldn't want to offend, or maybe they don't want to talk or whatever. So we talked about this too. Oftentimes we'll go, you know, in our cars, open the garage door, drive in, close the garage door, go in the house, and we've been neighborly. We've waved, we said hi. Anyway, he challenged me to say, well, look, he's over there with some dirt in his own driveway, much more than what we had. Let's go over and help him. I'm like, sounds good. I was going to be here a couple hours doing my dirt. We're done early. Let's go help. That sounds great. Go over there with a wheelbarrow and a couple of shovels. And he's also very Canadian. He said, oh, no, I don't need your help right now. I, I'm okay with doing that. Get to talking for a few minutes, and he had a sore back. And so we ended up scooping, I can't tell you how many wheelbarrows of dirt, and he just went and dumped them. And then after that, was very appreciative. We spent 40, 45 minutes conversation while we were working and challenged myself to get out of my comfort zone, because I'm very much like what Jim was talking about in the backyard, the privacy, the everything in your backyard. If we could build a higher fence, I'd probably buy it. So just to encourage you all to do something simple like that. There's many more stories we could talk about, but just something simple as saying, let me help you with your dirt, or cut your lawn, or whatever the case is. Your neighbor's going on vacation. Hey, do you need your junk mail picked up or something like that? To do that and engage. And naturally, I wouldn't do that. His wife, a couple of days after we did the dirt there, his wife was very thankful because her driveway was now open for the car to park in. And so she yelled over, hey, thank you so much for helping my husband. Well, his back didn't hurt, and so she had a happier husband, and she was happier, and the family was happy. And they had time to spend together now because of that instead of him working outdoors. So don't know if that's an encouragement, but let it be an encouragement if you can to say just doing a simple thing like that to be mission in your own neighborhood. It's easier than you thought, even though it freaks you out. And even getting up and talking right now, I'm sitting here shaking, but it's okay. You can do that. We can talk about that. It's easier sometimes in a big group for me to do this, but the one-on-one, because what are they going to think about me? You know what? It was okay. They found out that we're human beings, and we talk, and it was okay. So let me encourage you to do that.
Thanks, Russ. Russ mentioned this acronym, BLESS, because when you talk about mission, it gets really complicated. You start talking like a theologian. But if you think in terms of BLESS, and we use this acronym, B, begin with prayer. Think about, ask God how you can be a blessing. To listen. Listen to the needs out there. Just don't invent something to do and hope everybody likes it. Listen. What are the needs? Three, eat with them. Eat. And then S, serve. Just serve. Just serve as God calls you to serve in meaningful ways. And then S, share ordinary stories, as we are doing today, is how God works through the ordinariness of our life. So that we are learning lots about fellowship. We are learning lots about how we might be a blessing into our neighborhoods. We're also learning a lot about how we lead these communities. We don't have a lot of control over what happens in each of these groups. We in fact, are trying to encourage personal ownership, team ownership of what's happening in Emmaus groups. That groups begin to sort of work together to say, what is God calling us to do? You don't need a pastor to direct the way, to tell you how to do it, what time to start, what time to end, what to do with the kids. Besides, Brian, are me going to do that for you? No. But to be able to work together as teams, shepherds, leaders, others, to make this happen. And so, one, thank you to all the leaders who commit to making this happen every month. Tone is one of the leaders. He's a host home. Him and Narosha offer their home to be able to have these events in Murrayville. Describe for us a little bit about how you guys work your leadership in your group.
We don't. Actually, I'm the least of the leaders. Actually, it's really about getting together as a team. My wife, Narosha, is taking care of some of the organizational things. We got Matt and Heather, you know, more thinking about the shepherd part of it, like how do we connect, how do we get the people engaged, bring them into our house. We're simply opening up our doors in our house and let community happen. So we're really trying to foster community swell engagement. So we're not trying to be the top-down leaders. It's more about coming alongside and just trying to kind of like get the flywheel going a little bit and let things keep going. Fan on the passion, fan on the community. And so we're not really spending a lot of time in coming up with programs or like we need to do. We're more thinking about like, hey, what are we going to do next month? What should we talk about? Or maybe someone is there wants to share something, which lately we have been doing every month. We have someone actually share something about their lives or, you know, things they go through. So it's really hands-off in many ways because we just want to see community happen by just trying to fan on the flame a little bit or swing the flywheel a little bit.
All right. And it seems that this your group is thriving. And most of these groups, many of these groups, have about 20 or 30 people, not always counting kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can be a large group. So it really is a different experience than maybe small groups has been for many of us. But it provides a great opportunity to gather, eat, and begin to bounce into people and begin to imagine what life can be mm-hmm. in our neighborhoods and how we can be a blessing to others. Thank you for hosting and all that kind of stuff. So those are a few stories of our Emmaus groups and some of the things that are happening. We are learning. And it is a bit of a change. We probably need down the road more groups, but we're not going to rush into that. We need to learn what we're doing and begin to expand and grow. But perhaps if you're not in an Emmaus group or not in something else that compels your time, I'd love to challenge you just to commit yourself to schedule that once a month meeting and be a part of what's emerging in the Emmaus group that's closest to you and be part of its development. I really encourage you to do that. Our homes and our neighborhoods are the heart of God's mission. It's a sacred place. It's a place of relationship, a place of refuge, a place of mission, a place of recreation. You can have a lot of fun. When that one teacher asked Jesus what was the most important law, and Jesus gave his answer, love God, love your neighbors. The one teacher that was listening to him in his house said, good answer, Jesus. And Jesus said, so what do you think? And Jesus said, well, good response. You are not far from the kingdom. It was a Pharisee, a teacher of the law, that asked him the question. He knew all the answers. He could recite them as well as Jesus. And yet Jesus discerned in his heart and his mind that he was really not bought in. He was close, not far from the kingdom. I suppose as we make our journey towards Emmaus groups, and I imagine as we press into this, learn, adapt, change, alter, as we make our way, the one conviction is for me wanting to live out my life within God's kingdom. I don't want to be just near to it, but right in the middle of it. And as a church, Pacific community, we are wanting to step right into the middle of it, even if we have no idea what that might mean. So if you haven't been to an Emmaus group, I encourage you to check it out, which one is closest to you. If you've been to one and haven't gone back, perhaps give it a second chance. Pray into the reality of God calling us into mission into our neighborhoods. And we do it because God has entered into ours through Jesus Christ. He made his dwelling amongst us. And he said to the disciples in the room above a house, he began the meal and he said, this bread is my body. It's broken for you. Eat it in remembrance of me. And in the same way, after the meal, after they had eaten together, it says, this cup, drink this in remembrance of me. It is a sign. It's the blood of the new covenant poured out for the forgiveness of all your sins. Drink this whenever you are together. And so this table is the same table we set in Emmaus group, so to speak. as we encounter one another. Let's pray. Jesus, you have set a table for us. And at this table, we are brought back into a place of relationship with you. We find refuge. We experience sacredness. We experience joy. Maybe not all at the same time, but as we continue to live at this table, life is nourishing us. And part of the life that you are nourishing in us is a life of mission. How you can be present in our lives, in the very ordinariness of our lives. So perhaps, Lord, you need to work powerfully in us and through us in order for us to transform the ways we think and act and behave in this world so that we can be your presence in the world. Father in heaven, we give you thanks for this table. We thank you that you reconciled us to yourself through your Son, Jesus Christ. And that as we eat and as we drink, you are forming us into one body. We give you praise for such a work that you accomplished and that we are invited to live into. Bless our hearts, our minds, and our lives in such a way that we may be filled with your goodness to be a blessing to the world.